Why don't you state your name and the name of your company?
William Burroughs, working for William Burroughs.
Okay. Well, first of all, I want to wish you a happy birthday.
Thank you.
How does it feel to be 70?
Well, not much different from any other time.
Is there any particular age in your life that you like the best, or are you satisfied with the current?
Well, I wouldn't say there was any particular age, no.
Let me ask you a couple of questions about yourself and how you started out as a writer. I know that you're from St. Louis, and now apparently you're back in the Midwest, you're in Kansas, Lawrence, Kansas. Why did you decide to go to Kansas?
Well, I had a number of friends in Lawrence. I spent a summer there and found that I could live there quite comfortably. I long considered leaving New York. In fact, I spent a year in Boulder, but I didn't like that. I don't like mountains. But Lawrence is a very pleasant town. It's a university town. It has a lot of trees and water, which I like, so I can get out in the country and do a little fishing, shooting, things of that sort.
Are you affiliated in any way with the University of Kansas?
Well, yes. I have a... not exactly teaching. I'm sort of a writer in residence there. That is, I gave a lecture... and we'll give a reading in March and make myself available to students. And occasionally I will take over a class.
How often do you get back into New York?
Only when I have business.
You lived in New York a long time, didn't
you? I lived in New York quite a long time, yes.
I know that you are a member of the Burroughs family, so long associated with the cash registers, but are you the first writing Burroughs in your family that you know of?
Well, my son, yes, yeah. I'm the first, certainly. But the family lost all connection with the company years before I was born. They were bought out for a very small sum. That's that.
Been different had they not done that, huh? For you?
Well, yes. If they hadn't done it, I would have been a very wealthy man. I doubt if I would ever have written the books that I have written. I doubt if I would have written anything. Show me a good rich writer.
I was thinking about that.
I mean, I'm inherited wealth.
No, I was thinking about who... the only one I can think of who might possibly lay a claim on being rich is Louis Auchincloss.
I don't know his work.
He's a Republican. A Wall Street lawyer.
Yes. But is he a good writer?
Well, I think he is. He wrote The Rector. I think his best-known book was The Rector of Justin. I remember the title. And he turns out a book a year.
Oh, really?
He says he's the only Republican writer he knows. When did you decide, at what point in your life did you decide that you did want to write?
Well, I didn't write anything until I was 35. And that was my first book, Junkie. Someone suggested that I should just try to put down my experiences of addiction, and I did. It was a very straightforward book. And when that was published, that gave me encouragement to continue. From then on, I was pretty much committed.
What did you do over that 35-year period before you began to write?
Various things. I had a number of jobs during the war that I held very briefly. As in point of fact, I didn't do very much.
What kind of jobs were they?
Well, I was a private detective, a bartender, an exterminator, and I worked in factories and offices. The only job that I held for any length of time was exterminator. Because that was easy. I could get my all my work done in 2 hours.
You left the United States and went abroad. What period in your life did you do that?
I left the United States in 1948. I lived for some time in Mexico. I made a trip through South America. And I lived in Tangiers, Paris, and London. I was back in 1965 for 1 year. But apart from that, I was more or less constantly out of the States from 1948 to 1973, when I returned very definitively.
Why did you become an expatriate?
Well, for one thing, I had my parents gave me an allowance of $200 a month. It wasn't a trust fund at all. They had a gift and arts shop in Palm Beach called Cobblestone Gardens. And they sent me $200 a month from that. Well, for one thing, you couldn't live on that in the States. Also, the laws, well, the drug laws were very, very oppressive at that time. You see, America has a much more liberal atmosphere now than it did 40 years ago or 30 years ago. It's changed immeasurably for the better.
How did your drug addiction begin?
Casual, as with people who were using drugs, and I started taking drugs and like the feeling most people do, and became addicted.
What drugs were you taking?
Morphine.
Did you use heroin at all?
Well, heroin, there's really very little difference between heroin and morphine. The idea that heroin is in a class by itself is possibly a little bit more addictive and more quickly addictive, but there's really not much difference. No, there wasn't much heroin around at that time.
How badly hooked did you become?
Well, what do you mean? A habit is a habit. They're all bad. Of course, if you have a very heavy habit, you're using a great deal, it's more difficult to get off than if you're using a small amount, but by and large. At one point in Tangiers, that was the only, say, really heavy habit I ever had, which was about, the equivalent of about 8 to 10 grains of morphine a day. That's heavy.
How did you take it?
Well, inject it.
How did you finance this drug addiction?
Well, that's $200 a month was ample.
In Tangier?
Yes, because it was legal. You could buy it right across the counter. At that time, it isn't anymore.
Were you able to write while under the influence of drugs?
Oh, certainly. The only drug that I can't write under the influence of, couldn't write under the influence of, and this, I think, is, I talked to other writers, is alcohol. I've never met a writer who could actually write when he was drinking.
Were you able to break the drug habit at all?
Well, yes. I took the apomorphine cure with Dr. Dent in London in 1957, and that was very successful.
Do you take drugs at all now?
No, alcohol and cigarettes, unfortunately.
But you do drink, but no longer any hard drugs.
No.
The quality of your work, do you believe that was indeed influenced by the drug addiction?
Well, I think that drug addiction was a very important reservoir of experience on which I drew. Certainly it was the entire substance of Junkie, my first novel, and then became a sort of a metaphor in Naked Lunch. So it was what may be purely negative for most people can become quite valuable for a writer.
You broke the habit. You broke your pattern of drug addiction. Do you have any advice to other people who may be beginning to use drugs?
No, the apomorphine treatment is very successful if they want to get off. Of course, getting off drugs is not all that difficult. It's vastly exaggerated. It's only a month. Whatever method is used, whether they use a slow withdrawal or whatever, they're going to be pretty much out of the woods in a month.
There were some painful episodes in your life for example, the shooting of your wife. Did the drug addiction that you have had an influence on that incident?
No, that was entirely alcohol. None whatever.
What kind of working pattern do you have now? Do you have a regular 9-to-5 day in which you function, or is it kind of a casual approach to writing?
Well, it's neither one nor the other. If I'm doing well, you know, if it's coming, then usually from about 10:30 to 5, I don't eat lunch. I just have a snack or something like that. But I'm definitely someone who works during the daytime. But if it there's no point in the writer trying to force himself. If it isn't coming, then do something else.
You're interested now, apparently, in the West. The theme of your new book is somewhat different. Can you tell me a little bit about how you approached that? Why you decided to use that theme?
Oh, well, I had been interested in the West and in guns and in the whole theory of weaponry for many years. Of course, the Cities of the Red Night is very much concerned with weaponry. Well, it's a war universe that we live in. And I chose that as for that reason, you see, that you have the old Western gunfight was sort of a Zen confront.
Burroughs, this is not a very coherent interview in some respects because I tend to jump around a lot, but let me go back a ways. You are associated with the Beat Generation, and yet I somehow don't picture you as a Beat, but I have the feeling that you were a terrific influence on people such as Kerouac and Ginsberg. Tell me about that period as the people who were known as the Beats began to write and your relationship with these people.
Well, you see, my relationship with them was mostly before they started to write, although Kerouac had written 1 million words when I first met him. But you see, that was in the mid-40s. Allen Ginsberg had just written a few poems, and I didn't consider myself a writer at all. In fact, I hadn't written anything and didn't really intend to become a writer. So, and then I wasn't in the States during the 60s. So that period was more just a period of friendship than, should we say, a literary association.
Tell me about your association with Allen Ginsberg.
Well, I've known Allen since 1945, and I see him all the time. Whenever we're in the same town, he was the one who introduced me to Boulder, the Naropa Institute. And for 5 years, I've been out there every summer teaching, giving a few lectures. So I saw him there, and he's living now in New York. Of course, when I'm in town, I see him. We have read together. Well, it's just a long-standing friendship and association over many years.
What are your recollections of Kerouac? What kind of person was he?
Well, I've written quite a bit about him. He was a writer. He was certainly a dedicated writer, never intended to be anything else. Some people think of him as a sort of a tough, brawling type, but he was very non-hostile and would go way out of his way to avoid a fight. he was the one who suggested the title, Naked Lunch. Always told me that I should write, that was what I was really fitted to do. So he was a very positive influence. I mean, he was more an influence on me than I was on him.
I was reading the Publisher's Weekly article about you, and it quoted you as saying, I don't have the article in front of me, but it quoted you as saying that you were repulsed by Naked Lunch yourself. Tell me about your feelings. Why did you feel that way about your own
life? I don't remember such a thing. Yes, I'd like to be precise.
When Naked Lunch was published some 25 years ago, Publishers Weekly, quote you as saying, the author himself called it brutal, obscene, and disgusting.
I never said such a thing.
I have you on record now. That's good.
Yes. However, I will say this, that I agree with Miller, who says that a writer is primarily someone who has antennae and simply hooks into something. And he may, in some cases, be appalled at what he's hooked into. I use the comparison of a map maker. Well, they said, well, why do you have this this swamp here? I said, well, because it's there. It isn't my decision.
Were you aware of the furor over Naked Lunch? You were not living in the country at that time.
No, I was not living in the country. Well, I heard about it, and naturally I was in Tangiers at the time. But remember that most of the cases brought were against Miller. And by the time all those cases had been settled, and Barney Ross of Grove Press financed the defense of the book with his own money, and by the time that all these Miller cases were settled one way or another, there wasn't much left of censorship, so we only had two cases. One in Boston, which we won on appeal, and one in Los Angeles, which we won in the lower court.
Your publisher fought those battles, I would assume.
Oh, yes.
Did you participate in the legal fight at all?
No. I was in Tangiers at the time.
Did anybody else try to censor or block your books anyplace else that you know?
No, I had surprisingly little trouble. Actually, Selby's had more trouble. Now, he had cases in England. I never had a single case.
What do you think about the climate, the change in our outlook toward reading material, indeed motion pictures, whereas particularly in the 40s, 30s, 40s, in the 40s, movies had to have happy endings, and books could not have profanity. Even Mailer's Naked and the Dead couldn't use the word F-U-C-K. It had to be changed to F-U-G, I believe.
Yes.
How do you see the change in the way Americans, indeed much of the world, looks at life and literature?
Well, I think we've seen in the past 40 years a worldwide cultural revolution of just of unprecedented magnitude. That has even gotten through to the hermetic Arab world, and seems even to have penetrated the Iron Curtain. This is partly repercussions of the Beat Movement. As you, the Buddhists say, you drop a pebble in here, and the ripples go out. And we have seen in that period the end of censorship, the virtual end of censorship. Of course, the end of the Vietnam War, decriminalization of marijuana, cannabis, and a very much more liberal attitude towards drugs in general. Minority rights. It's a very salutary change. I think it's comparable to the liberal revolution of 1948, which was also a worldwide phenomenon. Oh, this has spread over about 40 years. And many people took part, publishers, filmmakers, writers, painters. Allen Ginsberg was certainly one of the heroes of the Cultural Revolution. He was the first to get up in front of audiences of fraternity brothers and talk openly about homosexual experiences. Now, that was... heavens, 20, 25 years ago.
Let me go back to the drugs you mentioned, the liberalization of drug laws in this country. Do you have any moral objection to drug use today?
No, or to anything else. Well, except crimes against person and crimes against property, but the so-called victimless crime, I think, should be removed from the books.
So your objection to drugs is more of a physical nature as to what it can do in a negative way.
Well, that has been vastly overestimated, the idea that drug addicts invariably die in a few years. Absolute rubbish. I mean, Crabb, who was addicted for 50 years, lived to be 90. De Quincey lived in, well, into his 70s. I mean, the physical effects are vastly overrated, or overestimated.
Well,
there's been a terrific amount of disinformation on the whole subject put out by official quarters, particularly by the American Narcotics Department. Just a series of myths, misconceptions that one becomes addicted with a single dose, that you have to keep raising the dose. This is all nonsense.
Would you want to see the legalization of drugs?
I think it'd be the only solution. It worked very well in England. It wasn't complete legalization, but anyone could obtain drugs on prescription quite easily. An addict could quite easily obtain drugs on prescription. And it worked very, very well indeed, but then Americans got over there, and now they have the same mess that we have.
William Burroughs, to kind of wrap things up, I just want to go back a little bit about and ask you a couple of maybe pleasant things. When you were growing up in St. Louis, what did you read? What were some of the authors that you liked in those days?
Well, let's see. I remember reading all the little blue books, because those were a number of authors were put out in these little blue books by E. Hellman Julius. Oh, I read, I read Anatole France in Transylvania, Oscar Wilde, Fitzgerald, Conrad, Melville, and I also read adventure stories, weird tales and amazing stories and Western stories. A wide variety of readings.
All those weird tales, Western stories, play a role in your current writing, too.
They do indeed. They do indeed. I got some excellent ideas.
Who are you reading today?
Well, I don't read a great deal of serious writing. I read spy books, doctor books, horror stories, mostly for entertainment when I'm traveling on planes.
They call it trash.
Yes. Yes, but you can sometimes pan nuggets out of trash.
How did you, what was your reaction to to Burroughs, the documentary motion picture? I guess that was completed a year ago and is now open for public consumption.
Yes. Well, I feel it's a very competent job. I'm very well pleased with it. Of course, I had nothing to do with the structuring of it or the final choice of materials. It was about 50 hours. And from that, Howard Buchner has chosen 80 minutes. And, of course, if I'd have made the choice, it would have been a different choice. But somebody had to make it, and I think he's done a good job.
Why did you decide to reveal yourself so much in that film?
Well, I didn't see any reason not to. I'd already done it in my writing. As Maugham says, anyone that writes reveals himself completely in his writing, if anyone knows how to read. So I thought it was already a fait accompli anyway.
Well, you came to New York to celebrate your birthday. I know there were a lot of parties for you, and of course the movie opened and the book came out. A very exciting week or so. What's next? When do you go back to Kansas?
Work. Gotta get to work on my new book.
Back in Lawrence?
Yes.
Well, how do you have your workspace set up in Lawrence? What kind of place do you live in?
Oh, I own a small house there with two bedrooms, living room, bathroom, a living room and dining room. Well, I just work at a desk, as I always have.
Mm-hmm. What kind of do you have a library? You obviously have a personal library. How do you have that set up?
Oh, just a few bookcases. Not an extensive library at all.
Do you have a collection of Burroughs?
Unfortunately, no. People are always bringing me books to sign, and I don't have, like, Big Table, first editions of Naked Lunch. I didn't realize that these things were going to have any value. I wish now that I had set aside 20 or 30 of the first editions of every book. But I didn't.
I wish I'd kept mine. It was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.